Interestingly enough, a lot of what was shared is kind of based in the guy I'm going to be talking about. I have a question I want to start off with, and it's probably mostly a rhetorical question, but have you all ever faced a situation that was new to you, and because of not having all the information or the wrong perspective on it, you just came in and made the wrong decision or got the wrong impression about what was going on? I do that pretty regularly, and especially if it's a situation that is new to you or if it has any kind of emotional, like if it's a scary situation or anything that's going to try to drag you one way or the other. It's very easy to get the wrong impression. And I was thinking about when I was growing up, I grew up on Your Story Hour, and there's one story I was remembering that gets a little bit more of what I'm thinking. It was during the Civil War, and there was these two brothers, an older and a younger, and the older brother was just old enough to sign up for the Army. So he signed up for the Union Army, went off, and they wrote back and forth for a while. They were very close, and I may get this a little bit wrong, because if others of you grew up on this story too, I apologize. But eventually he got a letter, the younger brother got a letter where he received the bad news that his older brother had fallen asleep on guard duty. And back in the day, it was very serious because that could cost a lot of people their lives. So that was punishable by death. And he had taken over someone else's second shift or something, and he was just so tired he fell asleep. So the younger brother is very distressed, and he decides he's going to take off and go to the camp where his older brother is and see if he can do anything about it, see if he can talk the commander into changing his mind. So he takes off, he gets partway there, night comes. He falls asleep beside the road, and along comes a stranger. And the stranger sees him there and wakes him up, asks what's going on. The younger brother explains the situation, explains what's going on, and they talk about it. And the stranger also has something that he's trying to work through that he talks about with the younger brother, and the younger brother is able to help him out with that. And I forget some of the details, but the stranger ends up saying, well, because you helped me out, I'm going to help you out. I'm going to actually save your older brother. And the younger brother is very confused because he wouldn't expect a stranger on the road to be able to do anything about that. But they go together to this camp where his older brother is, and they walk in the door. And the general, or whoever the commander was of the station there, looks at the stranger that's with the younger brother and says, Mr. President, welcome. So I guess before TV, not everyone knew what the president looked like. So this was Abraham Lincoln that was with him. I don't know if this is a true story. But the second that the younger brother heard that, his perspective immediately grew. He knew that there was power there that he didn't know was there before. And it changed his outlook on the whole situation. So maybe a little bit of a simpler illustration for you, but the same idea. And the reason I'm doing two is because this is going to be a major one throughout the whole sermon that I want to think about. I was thinking how I work with a crane, so I go lift stuff up with a crane. And I was thinking of how sometimes I would tell someone about how my day went. And I was imagining someone walking up into the conversation that had no idea what I do. And so I tell them, yeah, I went out and lifted 50, 150-pound trusses on top of the house. And then after, I went and put a hot tub on a deck. I'm really tired. That's a lot of work. And someone who had no idea what I did, that would not make sense. So let's visualize this. I was thinking of what to use for visualization, and I like chocolate, so figured it'd work for everything. So they hear me say that, and they're looking at me, not all that impressive, pretty small. And then they hear what I said that I did. They're like, that does not compare. That doesn't make sense. So all they see is that. They see me and what I say I did, and they don't have the whole story yet. So what are they missing? Information. They're missing a key party. They're missing what provided the power for this to happen. So they're missing the crane in this situation. And yes, this melted at some point. So So until they see this whole picture, they're confused. They don't understand the situation. When they're just looking at this, it doesn't make sense. When they hear all the information, it makes a lot more sense. So the reason I talk about that is because for our passage this morning, we're going to be talking about a man who, throughout his life, and especially in today's passage, did some amazing things, and a lot of it was because he saw the whole picture when the people around him were only focused in on part of it. So, turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17. I don't know if y'all remember my last sermon, but it was actually the chapter right before this about when David was anointed king. And so this is the chapter directly after that. And so if you remember kind of the life, the timeline of David's life, you might know what this is going to be about. And a lot of the lessons in these two chapters are fairly similar, but they're also very important. I was starting to think how to format this. I want to do it as simple as possible because I usually overcomplicate things. We're just going to read straight down through the passage. And it's a pretty long one, so just once. And I'll just try to bring out the context and the lessons as we go and just let the passage kind of be the outline. But if any of you are taking notes, the first half will be mostly context and story, and the second half will get more into lessons and applications. So, 1 Samuel chapter 17. Now the Philistines gathered their armies together for battle and were gathered at Succoth, which belongs to Judah. They encamped between Succoth and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side with a valley in between them. So let's visualize this, what this could look like. Here's a simple map. Israelites on the north, Philistines on the south, valley running through the middle. Something with a little bit more information on it. Might be harder to read. So the Israelites kind of owned this territory up here. Philistines controlled this down here. Israelite camp down here in the valley. Philistine camp over here. And every day they would march over to here. Philistines would march over to here. And they would meet in this valley. So that was what was going on in the setting. David's not part of this yet. He's not there, it doesn't seem. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Now, anytime you're reading a story and a guy who's 6 cubits and a span shows up, that's kind of a showstopper. So let's talk about that a little bit. Most of you will know how tall that is. Some of you younger ones might not. So 6 cubits and a span. A cubit is about the height from your finger to your elbow. On me, it's right about 20 inches. But the two average ones would have been either 20 or 18 inches. So you put those together, and then a span is pinky to thumb, about 6 inches. Put that together, 6 cubits, 18 inches, 108, divided by 12 for feet, 9 feet plus a span, 9 feet, 6 inches. Or if you use the longer one, you have 10 feet, 6 inches. So we'll split that and say it's about 10. So this was not just a slightly large man. This is almost a different category of fighter. And lest we be tempted to think this is just a little extra height, like this, if you think about how weight increases with height, it's most likely, by the research I did, most likely this guy weighed 400 to 500 pounds. Huge. So here's a little bit of a comparison. I'm 6 foot, so close to average, although Hebrews tend to be a little smaller, so probably 5'8"-ish. Saul, it said, back when he became king, was the tallest man in Israel. So let's say he's 7 foot. He's about here. And he's the tallest man they have. Goliath was somewhere way up here. That's towering above even the tallest people that Israel would have had. I don't know how accurate this is, but let's say I'm David, and that's Goliath up there. I really don't look like I'm going to stand much of a chance. And his head is at about 10 feet. I don't know if his body's in proportion or not. And this is maybe close to what he would look like if you could see the whole thing, but that's obviously way too small. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze, and he had bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam. And his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels, and a shield bearer went before him. So here we get some numbers of how much these things weighed. A shekel was, in Jesus' time, it was a coin. But back before that, it was a measure of weight, about half an ounce. So if you do the math, a lot of what he had was very heavy, which is why I have this. So I'm going to give someone a chance to hold that and tell me about how far you think you could throw it.
Probably 5 yards.
5 yards, okay. According to math that someone did, anyone else want to try it? Vincent? How far? Oh, now I'm doing comparisons. This isn't good.
4 yards.
So according to the measurements that the Bible gives, this is actually about 8 pounds less than Goliath's spear would be. I can't imagine fighting with something like that. This is 25 pounds. And then his armor, by the measurement it gives, just his chain of mail or whatever it was, would have been at least 125 pounds. This is not a small person. Interestingly enough, I found a website that said that Goliath was probably about 6 foot or 6 foot six, because we're misreading something, or different manuscripts have different measurements. But then in that same website, it calculates his armor and his weight and all that to come out to more than 200 pounds, just his armor and his weapons. I was like, I don't think someone my size or slightly larger is going to carry 200 pounds into battle. That's just not happening. So the reason I'm talking about this is because I want us to be able to look at this challenge a little bit from the Israelites' perspective. This isn't just, yeah, this is a battle where we're slightly outnumbered. Here's a spear that might be slightly closer to the length of Goliath's spear, but then I went and measured it. It's actually 4 feet short. So his spear would have been longer than the whole back wall. But later on, I want us to be able to put ourselves into the Israelites' perspective of what they're facing and how impossible this looks. Then he stood and cried to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the army of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." And this is very common. This is a thing that the armies did to avoid the high cost of battle all the time. They would just send out a champion from one army, a champion from the other army, and their battle would decide the whole battle. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. So, back to this down here. It makes a lot of sense why they would be dismayed and greatly afraid. But they were seeing not the whole picture. They were looking at part of the picture. And for them, which I cannot blame them at all, it was terrifying. Now, different scene in the story. We go to Bethlehem. This is where David is. And it says, David was a son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had 8 sons. And the man was old, advanced in years, in the days of Saul. The three oldest of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. The names of the three sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest, and the three oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So, David's living at the palace. If you remember from the last chapter, David, at the end of the last chapter, he had gone to the palace to serve Saul because Saul was being disturbed by evil spirits, and David was amazing at playing the harp, so he would go play for Saul. So David lived at the palace. He was in royal presence of royalty all the time, and yet he still went back to Bethlehem consistently, it seems like, to be a shepherd. And I'm not an expert on the culture that day, but I don't think shepherding was very high on the list of good jobs you could have or good reputations. So he was willing to humble himself and do that. And for all we know, that could have been the times, those times when he went back, that might have been the times where he killed the lion and the bear that we'll hear about later. Now it switches back to the Valley of Elah, the battle, for one verse. And the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. This is a detail I don't think I'd ever picked up on when I read it through before. This had happened every day for 40 days. Makes you wonder how long this would have gone on without an interruption. But the main point that I would think about is that everyone in Israel, all the soldiers in the battle, King Saul, his commander Abner, everyone had plenty of opportunity to do something about this, to stop this from happening. It's not like they were working up their courage and eventually they would have got there. If anything, it was probably going the opposite way. And the Philistines were enjoying this. They came out every day, line up for battle, send out Goliath, and watch them run. And I would almost be curious as to why they didn't just attack, but it might just be because they were on each side of this valley, and whoever attacked would have to try to climb the hill and fight at the same time, so that would be a disadvantage. Then Jesse said to his son David, now we're going back to Bethlehem. Then Jesse said to his son David, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves, and run to your brothers at the camp. And carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000, and see how your brothers fare, and bring back news of them." Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the Valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. Now, how many of you have read children's storybooks and David is a little boy? This is the first hint. I've read those. This is the first hint that might not be quite accurate. I don't know if the word run is literal or not, but David was carrying an ephah of dried grain, about 40 pounds, 10 loaves, I don't know what those were, 10 cheeses. He's got a load, and he's supposed to be running to the Valley of Elah. Bethlehem's over here. Valley of Elah's over here. According to Google Maps, that is about a 6-hour walk, 17 miles, with a lot of altitude change. So I'm guessing most of you would not give that that job to someone about this height. Probably not. And he got there before the army marched out for battle in the morning. So I'm guessing he didn't take 6 hours. So that's our first hint. I might talk to you a little bit more later, but that's our first hint that maybe David wasn't just such a little boy. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with a keeper, must have been very early in the morning, and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp as the army was going out to fight and shouting for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. And David left his hand in the supply of the supply keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his brothers. Then as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines, and he spoke according to the same words, so David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. So the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches, and will give him his daughter, and will give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel." Then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, so I guess he didn't hear what they just said. David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" So, we'll have more on this later, but notice what David takes offense over here. He says, someone is defying the armies of the living God. Now, nowhere that I've seen did Goliath come across and say, "Hey, I defy your God." He was defying the Israelites. But David recognizes the reality of what it means when someone, when God's people, God's representatives are looking bad. And I know it looks like I'm kind of guessing on that, but later in the passage, it will be very clear that that's what David was addressing. So he recognized the reality that insults to God's kingdom and his people and his representatives indirectly are making God look bad. And it's maybe a similar principle to what God says in the New Testament, where whatever you do to the least of these, you've done it unto me. And that's one reason why it is so important that we do represent him well. It's not just a matter of, well, we look bad if we do something wrong, but if we're representing Christ, that carries over to him. And so, for example, if our church is not functioning properly, if there's fighting going on in our church and people look on, they might not get the correct, beautiful picture of what the kingdom of God is supposed to be that they should. And David recognizes that. That's what's happening here. He recognizes that Goliath is making God's people seem weak, and it's making God look weak, and he took offense at that. And the people answered him in this manner, saying, "So shall it be done for the man who kills him." Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David. And he said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know the pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." And I really don't think Eliab was worried about David's sheep. Just doesn't seem like that's something he would care about that much. And his accusations were 100% false. We just read about how his father sent him specifically to send food to David's brothers. So David had every right to feel very aggrieved by this very false accusation, insult. And David said, "What have I done? Is there not a cause?" So, we see here David experiences a second insult. The first one was Goliath. This one is his brother. This one's different. This one is a personal insult against him. And I should have read a few more verses, but you'll see that he quickly drops this insult. He doesn't hang on to this one. But he does not do the same for the insult against God. And that brings up something that, for me, I find more and more convicting the more I think of it, is how easy do I find it to ignore insults against myself versus insults against God? Or how do I react differently when someone lies about me versus when someone says things that are not true about God? And I don't think I come out anywhere close to where David is on this. Then he turned from him toward another and said the same thing. And these people answered him as the first ones did. So I missed studying this. I'm not quite sure why he asked the same question multiple times. But he's continuing on this path of trying to find a way to rectify this insult against God. And he didn't react to Eliab's insult, but he kept going, even though what he's doing is the same thing that got him in trouble with his older brother to begin with. Now, when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for him. Now, I was thinking about this. Saul is the leader of Israel. He's probably watching the battle from somewhere. And he hears this report that someone who's not even one of his soldiers is asking questions about what will be done if you kill the giant. And he immediately snaps that up. I don't know, this is speculation, but Saul was the tallest person in Israel. He was the commander of the army. He was the king. You would think it would have been his natural responsibility to take care of this situation. He would have been the most fit person in Israel to take care of this. So maybe this is partly self-preservation, that he's desperately looking for solutions to this, that he would call a young person that was probably too young to even be in the army. So David came, and David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail you because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." So we can see that Goliath's challenges were doing more than just embarrassing the Israelites. It was embarrassing them, but it was more than that. Goliath's challenges were making it harder for the army as a whole to fight because of their fear of him. And like, if there was an actual battle, a few people would be fighting him, but there's a whole army on each side. But because of Goliath's challenge and the way he had their hearts fearful, he was affecting the army as a whole. Now, I think it is very fair to compare Goliath to sin. Because if you think about it, in the story, Goliath is insulting God, making his people look weak, and sin does a lot the same. Sin in our lives is an insult to God. It makes us look weak. And this makes me think about how sin behaves in our lives. Like I said, I feel like I've had a lot of good introduction to this before I even got up here. But I was thinking about how sin behaves in my life particularly. How when there's something big that I have not had triumph over, it doesn't just affect the one area of my life that it happens to be in. If I'm struggling with, let's say I'm struggling with laziness and I haven't overcome it yet. It's not like, okay, I can be lazy over here, but everything else that I do is fine. No, that laziness is going to come over to my prayer life. It's going to come over to my relationships. It is going to affect the entire spiritual battle that I'm fighting. Just like Goliath is affecting this entire battle and keeping the Israelites from doing what they should have. And Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are a youth, and he a man of war from his youth." So, we can see from this comment that David is young. He's definitely young and probably too young to fight. I don't know what that age would have been. But I'm also going to give you a few reasons why he probably was not just a little boy, like we talked about before. The first is what we already said. Secondly, in the chapter before, he was already described in ways that didn't sound small, like a mighty man of valor. Third, he had already killed a lion and a bear, which I realize those could be miracles. So, fourth, King Saul, a little bit later, is going to offer David his armor to kill the giant, which he wanted to be successful. That would be very counterproductive to give a 4-foot-tall person a 7-foot-tall person's armor. And finally, David was able to wield Goliath's sword whenever he got it, which would have had to have been very large and heavy. So none of those are watertight, but put together, it was probably true that David was not a small person. I know several 15-year-olds that are bigger than I am. But this comment still makes it clear that when Saul looked at David, he saw someone that was a no match for Goliath. He saw someone that was not nearly strong enough, not nearly big enough, and just a completely different category, did not have the training, did not have the armor, did not have what Goliath had. But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose and caught me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing as how he has defiled the armies of the living God. So, if David stopped there, I think we would have some reason to maybe question what he was thinking. So he's saying, I killed a lion and a bear. Is he saying that I just think that my power is just greater than the lion and the bear, and I was just able to kill them because I'm that much stronger? If that's all he's saying, then we have a lot of reason to question why he thinks he would be able to take out Goliath. I don't know that you can. I personally have no idea how hard it is to kill a lion and a bear barehanded. I'm guessing it would be harder to kill a 10-foot giant who's armed and ready for you. But the key to it is in verse 37, where David says, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. So, David has a new factor in here. David sees what other people are not seeing. Saul and the people around him are seeing David, and even if they believe that he could kill a lion and a bear, they're seeing Goliath, and they're saying there's no way this can happen. David is seeing a bigger picture than they are. And that's a big chocolate bar, but it does not compare to how God would compare to Goliath. And the reason that's important is because this is what made David different from the other people that were there that day, or at least part of it. Everyone else that was there, they were there to fight. David wasn't even there to fight. He showed up to bring food. Everyone else had run away from Goliath 40 days straight. Well, probably, assuming they all showed up at the same time. But David saw the situation differently than they did. So first, he saw an insult to God where everyone else just saw danger to themselves. And then second, what I was showing here, is he was able to see this situation as all being under God's control. So whether or not he is smaller than Goliath, whether or not he was smaller than the bear and the lion, doesn't make a difference to him, because he's seeing the principal connection as being that God is bigger than these. So Saul wasn't going to stand in the way of this. Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." So Saul clothed David with his armor, and he put bronze helmet on his head, and he also clothed him with a coat of mail. So Saul is doing what he can. I mean, obviously later in the story, he doesn't like David very much, but as of now, he's doing what he can to help him. So David fastened his sword to his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. And David said to Saul, "I cannot walk with these, for I have not tested them." So David took them off. Not necessarily because they didn't fit, he just wasn't used to them. In fact, it almost implies maybe they did fit, and he was actually an extra large person, so who knows. Then he took his staff in his hand, and he chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, and he put them in a shepherd's bag, in a pouch which he had, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. So the Philistine came and began drawing near to David, and the man who bore the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and good-looking. So the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." So once again, what was Goliath seeing? Goliath was seeing these two. He's seeing himself, seeing David, and he sees no problem. The Israelite army was seeing these two. They were probably gearing up to be slaves. The Philistine army saw these two, and they were excited. They're like, "We get to watch them run again, and maybe this time we'll actually go chase them." But David sees something that you'll have to wait, and I'll read it for you. David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." And that's what I was talking about. It is clear what David took offense over here. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give it into your hands. So this is the crux of the story. This is the main part here. How did David view the situation? We've already talked about this, so it's not a surprise. But he didn't see the comparisons between himself and Goliath. That was irrelevant to him. He said the battle is the Lord's. So bear with me while I go on something that might look a little bit like a bunny trail. This is called a terebinth tree. In the Middle East, they called it an Elah tree, I think. And it was one of the largest trees that could grow over in the desert conditions that they had. I'm not sure which language is Elah and which language is terebinth, so I'm assuming Elah is probably Hebrew. Maybe they both are. Anyway, this tree shows up quite often in the Bible. This is the tree under which Jacob buried the idols of Laban. This is the tree that the angel came and visited Gideon under. But the most famous place this is mentioned is right here in 1 Samuel 17, in the Valley of Elah. So this valley is actually named after this tree because there's a large amount of trees there that are growing there. And actually, there's still trees there that, to this day. There's one that is 55 feet tall and 17 feet around, I hear. I haven't seen it personally. So presumably the valley got its name from these trees that were native to it. And because these trees were one of the biggest things around, they were very strong, they would regenerate well, they became a symbol of strength, and particularly divine strength, God's strength. Some commentators would even say they were possibly a representation of God to some people. And later on in the Old Testament, you see the Israelites maybe taking that too far, because the prophets actually talk about these trees and reprimand the Israelites for worshiping, either worshiping these trees or worshiping under these trees. So I don't know if that's connected or not. But these trees, I believe, were seen as a symbol of God's power. So, and I apologize if I'm wrong on that, but it does not affect the message of this passage. It's just for our visualization purposes. So imagine David. That's David. He's 6 foot tall. And, by the way, I take no credit for these sketches. I'm not nearly good enough. He's 6 foot tall, and he's looking up at about a 10-foot Goliath. And that's what most people are seeing. But let's say that David looks beyond that, and he sees this massive 25, 50-foot tree right behind Goliath that to him represents God's power. So, do I know that David saw that? No. But physically, I don't know if he saw that, but spiritually, it's clear that he saw God's power as towering over God's enemies. And that's the visualization that I think he had, I think we could have. And that was a defining characteristic of his life. That's a lot of what made David who he was. He had the correct view of God. He had the correct view of himself. And even, for example, you can see in the few mistakes that he makes, like when he counted his army, he numbered his men after God had told him not to. That was a lapse in this judgment. Like, God, over all throughout his life, he had counted on God to fight his battles. And then one day he's like, let me count my men and see how strong I am. Well, I wonder if I could just protect Israel by myself. Maybe I'm stronger than everyone else. I'm not 100% sure what his motivations were, but that would fit. But as a whole, that was his life. That was one thing that defined his life and one thing that made him who he is. And so I think that's a clear application for us as well. So when we're making decisions, we're trying to decide what God has for us, what to take on, what are we basing that decision on? Because if we're basing it on us, we're going to become overwhelmed. There's a lot of decisions in life. Some of them might look manageable. A lot of them will not. And especially if you have the wrong view of yourself and you don't realize how small you are, you will drastically miscalculate. But if you're basing it on yourself, you're going to be overwhelmed. If you're basing it on God's power, it's different because none of these, every challenge you're going to face is smaller than that. So let's move on here to verse 48. So it was when the Philistines arose and came and drew near to meet David that David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. Then David put his hand in his bag and drew out a stone, took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead. So the stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. So that's the victory, that's the triumph in the story. It's an amazing story. A question that came to me when I read this is thinking about, so David had this sling, he was skilled with it, he obviously was following God well before this. Could God have used just anyone to do this? Couldn't he have just selected a Israelite soldier and said, you go do this? Or was it important that David had prepared for it and that he was ready for it? So did this happen because of God's power or David's skill? And I think most of us would instantly respond, this is God's power that made this happen, which I believe that's true. But why then is it necessary for us to put in the effort to grow spiritually and to be ready for these challenges when they come along? That's way too big of a topic to be a subpoint of this message, but I did want to mention it because it's kind of key, and I enjoy talking about it. So I think the Bible makes it very clear that we are to be preparing and strengthening ourselves for to win spiritual battles. That's an important part of the spiritual life, sanctification and discipleship. But at the same time, we rely on God to control the outcome, like David did here. So that's paradoxical logic. If you try to put those together in your brain, it will make your brain hurt. But I think it makes sense because I wouldn't expect a God that the Bible describes, I wouldn't expect everything about him and how he works to make sense to us. So I'll just give you a quote here that I heard recently I've been thinking about by Timothy Keller. He says, God in his sovereignty relates your choices partially to your destiny, but he is the one who fixes everything. So I'm still thinking through that one. But notice how David says, the battle belongs to the Lord. But then what does he do? Does he sit down and watch God fight the battle? No, he picks up a sling, runs at the giant, and fires a stone at him. So you might wonder how that makes sense. But I think it is very, I think it's okay to say that God was the one who orchestrated the victory for Israel that day. And at the same time, it's important that David had prepared himself and not wasted his time over those years. And I think it's the same is true for us. Now the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley and the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell along the road to Shurim, even as far as Gath and Ekron. And the children of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their tents. David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, and he put his armor in his tent. Quick side note here that some of y'all may enjoy. I was reading this and I thought back to when Saul was elected king, Samuel tried to talk the people of Israel out of having a king because God didn't want that. But the people of Israel said, we want a king specifically, chapter 8, verse 19, we will have a king over us so that way we may be a light to the nations. Our king may judge us and go out and fight our battles for us. So if you remember that and then look at this battle right here, it's very ironic. The children of Israel got a king specifically to do this, and Saul's watching from the hilltop while David goes out there and fights the battle. When Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, "Whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." So the king said, "Inquire whose son this young man is." Then as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" So David answered, "I am the son of your servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite." So that's the end of the passage. The ending part is kind of confusing. The first couple of times I read it, the timing didn't make sense to me because if you remember the last story, David had been in Saul's court playing the harp for him. So why would Saul be asking about who he is here? And it's not that important, except for I could imagine people looking for contradictions bring this up. So there's actually several ways this could make sense. First one is being that a lot of time had passed, could have passed between these two chapters. Maybe Saul forgot. It's unlikely. But secondly, Saul maybe wanted to give a public ceremony, and he needed his family information. He would want his family there, and that's why he took the chief of his staff, Abner, and sent him in this mission. Or the one that makes the most sense to me is if you remember what Saul promised to whoever would kill Goliath, he promised that your father's household will be exempt from taxes. So he may have known who David was, but the question he asks is, who is David's father? So he could fulfill his promise. So that's the end of this chapter. I was going to look at another passage that gives us a lot of insight into what David's mindset was here. I don't think I will for time's sake, but if any of y'all have time this afternoon and you are bored, look up Psalm 9. It's not 100% sure, but it's most people's best guess that this is a psalm that David wrote specifically about this encounter or directly after this encounter. And so it gives us some valuable insight into how David's mindset was and what made him act the way he did. And the beginning of the psalm clearly brings about how his priority was to praise God and see God get the glory for things that happened. And that matches up perfectly with this passage. That's what made David act to begin with, as he saw an insult to God where God was not getting the glory that he deserved. And then towards the end of the psalm, you'll see that David brings it back to asking God to take care of his enemies, so acknowledging that God is the one that is over his enemies, and then so that he could praise God. And that attitude and that focus is what made David the great king that he was. So I would like to start wrapping this up. A few quick applications for us. I'm going to keep them quick because this is not the way I want to end. And this is mostly a summary. But following David's example, here's at least three things that we can remember. The first is it's okay to be offended over offenses to God. It's good, actually. Eliab offended David personally. He didn't take offense at that, and that is also true for us. Personal offenses are not something we should take. But when Goliath offended God, David responded. And I personally think we could probably do with even more fervor in that area. Secondly, is the main point we were talking about, is have David's perspective. Have the right view of ourselves and have the right view of God and the right view of the challenges that come along. And thirdly, remember our place in God's plan. I don't know if you've thought about it before, but God really could have killed Goliath by himself. He could have done that. But he chose to use David, and he chooses to use us as well. I'm not saying that he will never do that, but as a rule, he wants to use us and what we have to offer to accomplish his plans. So like I said before, David went out there and he declared boldly, "The battle belongs to the Lord." And then he immediately went and fought it. And I don't think it's wrong for us to do the same, whether it's in our prayer life or spiritual battle of any kind, for us to say, "The battle belongs to the Lord, now let's go fight it." Even if logically that might make you think a few times. So I want to end with thinking about how does this story relate to the gospel? So as I mentioned before, I think it's very fair to compare Goliath to sin. So Goliath, what he would have meant to the Israelites without this interference from David and God would have been slavery and death. That's what sin means to us. Sin means slavery and death. And let's call this the sin. This is sin. This is us. We do not compare to it. We cannot of our own self-will overcome this. And we have no power over death. Even with all our technology that we have these days, we can slightly delay it, but we have no power to overcome death of ourselves. Now, God is far greater than our sin. Like I said, this comparison is not accurate. He is far, far greater than our sin. And he showed that clearly. He showed that when he died on the cross. He showed that during the resurrection. He showed that in today's story in 1 Samuel 17, overcoming Goliath. And I'm going to leave you with one mental picture yet. If you remember the picture of David looking up at Goliath and seeing a tree representing God's power right behind him, whether or not that's what actually happened, that's accurate for what David, that seeing that power is over David's enemy was accurate. And we have a similar picture that is true for us when thinking about the sin that is in our lives that is trying to enslave us and cause us death. The power of the gospel is in recognizing that the key victory over sin doesn't happen right here. Key victory over sin is happening in here. And that's why we can have the confidence like David had. And that is the perspective I would like to leave y'all with this morning. So thank you for listening.